I don't care how miserable it is. It's just life. Life is miserable.
Hello, everybody. This is Again With This, Dawson's Creek. Today's episode is Season 6, Episode 11, Day Out of Days. Day Out of Days? Day Out of Days! And now here are your hosts.
Tara Aranio and Sarah D. Bunting.
Just wanted to cover all my bases.
Okay.
Didn't know how they wanted me to put the emphasis on them.
Mm-hmm.
Miserable, miserable days. Hello, Tara and Dave.
Hi.
Hello, listeners. First of all, we're going to break some news. Our club members got this news a couple weeks ago, but by popular demand, our next Monday show is Felicity. We will drop our episode on the Felicity pilot on Monday, September 14th. The week after that will be Dawson's Creek, Season 6, Episode 14. And then Felicity and Dawson's will alternate on Mondays until the Dawson's series finale in early February 2027.
Mm-hmm.
If you've been around a while, you remember that we do this at the end of each show. We just braid them in so everyone can kind of ease in and out.
We do. Not getting eased in, the next episode we are going to be covering of my so-called life, that is Guns and Gossip. Just gets right to it. That is dropping this Thursday, August 20th. So if you are in the club, you're going to hear it.
And you're also going to hear on Friday, August 21st, again with this episode 300. Let's watch Daphne Zuniga and Carmen Argenziano in Quarterback Princess. Mm-hmm. It is on YouTube. We will link it in the show notes. You should check it out. If you remember it from when you're a kid, like I did, it does kind of hold up.
Mm-hmm.
And we hope you'll join us.
We do. Carmen Argenziano, for anyone who is wondering, played Dr. Stanley Levin for a time, Michael's boss at the hospital in Melrose Place, until, if I recall correctly, Michael rat fucks him out of being the chief resident or something.
Michael Mancini? What?
I know. I'm sorry to tar his name. Again, with this podcast.com/club is where you get all that. Let's start this four silo episode. It's been a while since we've had this many.
Mm-hmm. Didn't miss it.
No, I didn't either. Starting with our D plot, Pacey and Emma get to know each other near Fish. We open this one with Pacey looking across a tour group at an aquarium to Emma, who is sitting next to a tank sketching fish. She's surprised to see a stockbroker in a place like this, but he spends his lunch hours there all the time, he says. She orders him to sit on the adjacent bench. He jokes about her being overwhelmed by her sexual attraction to him. So I guess we're supposed to think their makeout after the holiday party was a one-off they haven't talked about since.
Or they're in another timeline completely, except they're not because Audrey, but I don't even know.
No, she just doesn't want anyone to think that she's with him, she says. When he asks, she says that she's just killing time until 1 o'clock. He doesn't know what happens then because he always leaves by 12:45, so he doesn't accidentally take a lunch hour and a half, in which case she doesn't want to keep him. It's 12:46, so he wanders off, and then it's the next day. They're back at the aquarium exchanging origin stories. She was prepared for a life of boredom and repetition as a drummer by studying violin as a child. Her mother taught piano to a succession of dog allergic students. Pacey figures out this meant the family had fish, and that's why she's still into them. He does not have a comparable reason for being attracted to the aquarium, but says he's not as conservative as Emmett thinks he is. She dares him to prove it by staying at the aquarium and calling out sick for the rest of the day, giving him her cell phone to do it, which I simply don't believe that Pacey, the BMW driver, does not have his own better phone, but...
No, I also don't believe that Emma, as written and conceived in her cheap apartment, being a bar manager and a drummer, has enough money to pay admission to an aquarium every day. They're not free.
Aren't they?
Are they?
I don't know. I assumed it was a suggested donation kind of a thing.
Oh, maybe. I'm just that sucker that never did that and just paid the suggested donation because things cost money.
Yeah. But she is still a student at Berklee School of Music, as far as we know, which it doesn't come up here at all. She has all the time in the world to not go to class and keep coming.
Yeah. Okay.
But anyway, Pacey does work up some subtle fake coughs to sell his sudden illness. And then it's the next day. Apparently, Pacey's called out again because we're watching him in a leather jacket and jeans and not a suit. Find out what happens at the aquarium at 1 p.m., which is a guy gets into the tank in a wetsuit and feeds the fish. Pacey doesn't get why watching big fish eat little fish is such a draw for Emma that she comes to watch it every day. She thinks if it were a big company eating a little company, he would get it. After all the time they've been spending together, she still doesn't understand why Pacey wanted to change his old life. He thinks he was just growing up. Why does someone dye their hair, for instance, like her? To piss off her mom, Emma says, and to be a different person, which, I mean, she's not that committed. I'm pretty sure those are clip-ins, but that's what Pacey wanted, too. Pacey at 15 had a bad haircut, bad Hawaiian shirts, was broke all the time, chased things he couldn't have. Emma says that Pacey at 15 sounds nice and that he should quit the job, shave the goatee, and get the bad haircut back. Pacey's been thinking about that lately, he says. Emma won't believe it until he comes back tomorrow at 1 in what she calls a Hawaiian t-shirt, and I guess they didn't have time shooting in the aquarium to give her another take. These stolen meetings would be a lot cuter if we did not know, by the way, they still live together and could be having these conversations at home without the time pressure, but whatever. Mm-hmm. On Friday, Pacey's sitting at his desk in an Aloha shirt, watching the crooked clock tick closer to 1. Rinaldi stops by his desk to be passive-aggressive about Pacey's interpretation of casual Friday and how calling out sick means his colleagues have to cover for him, which I'm pretty sure is not how commission-based jobs work at all.
No, I'm sure they were happy he was out so they could take his call list.
Yep. Pacey says Rinaldi's problem is probably that his compensation is based on his underling's performance and everyone else in Pacey's class doesn't open as many new accounts as he does. Rinaldi razzes him for unearned confidence and then stops a woman who's walking by with a stack of envelopes, handing Pacey his. It's Pacey's W-2, and he's guessing Pacey made a lot more there than he would as a fry cook. Pacey can quit the brokerage whenever he wants, but clip two.
But as long as you work here, the only lunches you're going to be going to are the ones you cater. And you're mine.
What?
Ooh. I'm so tired of this. Like, even the people in this storyline don't seem invested in big bad Rinaldi.
No.
I don't care.
It's so boring.
It's so boring.
I was sort of interested in the Emma Pacey makeout, even though it felt like it came out of fucking nowhere. But then they just dropped that for 2 episodes, too. And have them back by themselves, not in the apartment with Jack about to walk in with his burrito any second, and still not kissing again. So what?
Yeah. Like this, you have Joshua Jackson do something with him, but...
Yeah. And yet, the storyline still isn't over, because we cut from there to the aquarium where Emma waits while Pacey the coward stays at his desk, and she perks up when she sees a dark-haired guy in an Aloha shirt, but it's someone else, and then it's 1:30, so Emma picks up her purse and leaves, and that's where we leave them for now. On to the C-plot. Let's see how well Wilmington, North Carolina can play LA. On set, Todd very formally asks Dawson for the official time. It's 12:07 a.m. on a Monday, and a black screen breaks in to give us the day in case we weren't listening. This continues through the episode. They have finished principal photography, clip 3.
So, although it's rather out of character for me, I'd like to take this opportunity to thank all of you for all your hard work and to propose a toast to us and our movie. Cheers.
Aww.
Depending on whether we're looking at her in the long shot or the close-up, Natasha watches this speech looking either pleasant or bitchy. You can see both versions in the visual aid, side by side. Yep. When that's done, she strolls over to Dawson, commenting on how strange it is that tomorrow this will all be gone like it never existed. Dawson says hi, and she responds with aggression. Clip 4.
Nice speech, by the way. And don't even bother trying to pretend that it was Todd's idea, because that puppy had you written all over it. sincerity, warmth, and a hint of something, I don't know, bittersweet? Or is it just bitter?
Well, that's what rap writers are all about, aren't they? Not any more experienced than I am.
Also, she dumped him? Like, why does she have this attitude?
Yeah. Also, he was fine with it.
Yeah.
Are we doing this again? This territorial thing? Like the cat playing with its food? Stop.
Yeah. They go back and forth about their travel plans, and there's this clip 5.
Max got me a small part in that Spielberg film he's doing. You know, it's like 2 days' work or whatever, but who knows? Maybe it'll lead to bigger things.
Knowing you, Natasha, I'm certain it will.
Is that a little attitude? A break in the oh-so-professional on-set demeanor you've been cultivating since the new year?
Not everyone on the planet is acting every second of their lives, you know.
No, maybe not. But in Hollywood, they are. So, goodbye, Dawson. Good luck out there. I have a funny feeling about you.
What's that?
That you're gonna need it.
Well, we're about to find out he's really got it, so, you know, that's nice of her.
Also, this part that you're bragging on, you got by fucking the guy, which is fine if that's your play, but you also will need luck if that's your play.
Right. I mean, they sort of have hinted around that she got this job by fucking a guy, the guy being Dawson, so, you know.
Yeah.
Then we're in a conference room in L.A. where a studio executive named Larry Newman, played by Paul Gleason, is reading from test screening comment cards, clip 6.
Blindingly dull. Achingly dull. Mind-numbingly dull.
Ah, they showed them season 6, eh?
Yeah. If that voice sounds familiar, it's because he's the principal from The Breakfast Club, so you may hear us talking about that at some point in the future. Based on the episode timeline, they wrapped principal photography literally yesterday morning, so no, they are not focus grouping this movie yet, but fine, I guess, if we have to keep this moving so fast. Larry wants to do reshoots to add sex, violence, and a twist that isn't predictable from the first frame. Todd pulls out a cigarette to help get him through this abuse and orders Dawson to get him a light. Instead, Dawson drops something in Todd's coat pocket and steps out to get one, but actually to use a phone in the hall to call the phone he just planted on Todd and order Todd out of the room before he makes things worse. In the hall, Todd barks that he's being difficult on purpose. Clip 7.
You never want to work again?
We're in charge here. We make the decisions.
Dawson's not a part of we. He's just some kid.
Yeah. Why is he even still there?
Yeah. Well, they go on. Clip 8.
It's their money. Look, you brought me here for my ability to stay calm in a crisis, right? Well, this is it. This is a crisis, because if you don't go back in there and act happy about these reshoots, they're going to get somebody else to do it, somebody who can ruin this movie.
And would that be such a tragedy?
Yes. Look, maybe I'm naive for thinking that this whole system, this whole process, can only produce something that's a notch above mediocre, but I want this thing to be good. I want it to be as good as it possibly can be. And I don't think I would have stuck it out working for you this whole time if you didn't want the same thing.
I mean, sure. But, like, if you're trying to keep Todd on the show, this is just, like, a weird way to do it. This is all very weird.
Yeah. They're glossing over a lot of stuff that really makes no sense in terms of the employment of both of these people. Like, Todd wouldn't have gotten this job if he was this stroppy all the time.
Yeah. And how did they even get back to L.A. so quickly? Like, it just is, it's all really a lot of Law and Order-esque, like, from arrest to trial and conviction in 8 calendar days. Okay.
Yep. Anyway, back in the room, Larry's saying they envisioned 3 days of reshoots on a soundstage in L.A. Heather has convinced Larry that with enough nicotine, alcohol, and caffeine, Todd will be able to pull it off. Todd, your thoughts? Clip 9.
Well, I can see where you're coming from. I can. I can see where you're coming from. I can see how you and other people like yourself, people of lesser intelligence, might be a bit confused by my movie. And I can see how you actually don't have any ideas of your own on how to improve it, because, after all, you're not really in the business of having ideas, are you? Oh, that's right.
you think you are. Well, you're not. You're in the business of criticizing other people's ideas. Which is why, after much careful consideration, I'll be throwing your most generous offer back in your face and leaving. Goodbye. And good luck with all your future endeavors.
Okay.
Yeah, because that's how you talk to the C-suite, is by reminding them that they're not really creative and that you're definitely not taking any of their notes.
Mm-hmm. Also, from what we've seen of Todd's movie, that he's acting like is so above them, like it looks like bog standard early aughts horror schlock. Like,
mm-hmm.
If they don't get it, it's because it's not good, not because it's too elevated.
Yeah, or there's nothing to get.
Right. The next day, Dawson's back in the conference room, nervously waiting. When Heather and Larry show up, they assume they're there to watch Todd walk back everything he said the day before. But Dawson, jumpy as a cat, dropping his papers and knocking over his water bottle, admits that Todd's not actually coming because he doesn't know this meeting's happening. Heather figures out that Dawson set it up to clean up Todd's mess like he's been doing throughout the shoot, and Dawson does not deny it, but also promises that Todd wants the movie to be better and has five other possible endings in his head that could work. Larry does not care about any of that if Todd's not prepared to grovel. And then we arrive at the most improbable twist in this entire ridiculous story, as Heather realizes in the moment that actually Dawson could direct the reshoots himself. He knows the footage, actors, and crew. You know who else knows all that? The first AD, who probably has made other real movies before, but...
Yeah.
Let's pretend that person doesn't exist.
And the second AD, and the first AC, and like seven other layers before Dawson.
Before the, not even a production assistant, just the assistant to Todd.
Uh-huh.
Anyway, Dawson babbles that this isn't what he wanted to happen, but yes, if he had to do that, he could. Clip 10.
All right, call his agent.
I don't think he has one.
Well, then don't call his agent. Call his mother. Make her sign a permission slip.
Okay, wait a minute. Hold on a second. This is insane. This is not why I came here today. This is not what I wanted to have happen.
Well, guess what? It did. And since opportunities like this don't come along every day, I'd hop on the happy train. Or, I'm sorry, is being a director not the fulfillment of a dream you've been waiting your entire life for?
No, it is. It definitely is. But...
we'll be in touch.
But he's 18.
Yeah.
It's ridiculous.
Oh my God.
It's so stupid. Like, why are they... I know it's the last season, but you do not have to accelerate it this fast. It's
no.
Silly.
Did they know this was the end at this point?
I think so.
Okay. Well... still.
Then it's Thursday. Not that Audrey or, returning to no one's delight, Jack Osborne knows that, because they've been up all night at a beach party. Jack Osborne wants to take a cab, but his fame does not make Audrey any less broke, which Jack Osborne assumes means she's been paying too much for her drugs. She denies she's on any, but does not convince him. And before long, they see the friend that Audrey has called to pick her up, Dawson, whom she somehow knows is in town. As he makes his way toward them, Audrey says she's on thin ice with Dawson right now. Well, that's putting it mildly. He got a car driven into his house in the last episode by you.
Yeah.
So if Jack Osborne doesn't say anything about drugs around him, she will make it worth Jack Osborne's while. No, not with an unsupervised rummage through her underwear drawer. She'll just sit on his lap for the ride back. Yuck.
Ew.
Jack Osborne takes off before Dawson reaches Audrey. She claims that she forgot when she called him that she somewhat recently, as we've said, drove a car through his house, which, like, does make the idea that he would put himself out like this kind of a reach, but he just kind of asks what she's doing there, either at this party or in the city. She says one minute she and Jack Osborne were on Sunset talking to some weird guys in a limo, and the next they were here. Dawson was the only person in this area code that she knew would be up so early. And no, her parents don't know that she should be in school right now. She was not ready to go back yet, and she lied. But she's ready now, and she swears she'll be good from now on. She begs Dawson not to be any more mad than he already is, which I feel would be quite.
Mm-hmm.
But He just makes sure she knows how stupid it is to get in some strange guy's car. But she doesn't say anything, so I guess we can't assume she won't do it again. But maybe Dawson wanted to drive her to her house so he could go to the door with her and get a check from her parents for the contractor that's fixing Gail's house.
Slow down in front of Promises Malibu so she could tuck and roll up the front walk.
One of those.
Yeah.
Then we're on a different beach where Dawson's tracked Todd down after checking the surf report. Todd jokes about how dangerous it is for him to have someone out there with so much knowledge about him. He needs to erase Dawson's memory now that their professional relationship is over. Clip 11.
I came by to apologize.
For what? For stealing my job? Look, after you told them no yesterday, like the bloody idiot that you are, they called me. They even apologized. As much as they're capable of.
So what's next? We do reshoots here, we go back to Boston, what?
I'm sorry, mate. You misunderstood me. We're not doing anything. You are.
Wait a minute. I've been through this before. I'm not
gonna... Not gonna what? Not gonna benefit from being at the right place at the right time? That's all it is, you know? Doesn't mean you're actually going places. Or that you're more talented than I am, you know what I mean?
God, no. You're, like, fairly functional, but you're like my mentor.
What, not Steven bloody Spielberg?
Well, he hasn't been returning my phone calls.
Just don't make it any worse, okay? And listen, the absolute first thing you have to remember to do when you're on set is take a picture of Natasha's face at the exact moment that she's introduced to her new director. Because that's something I bloody well have to see.
That will be pretty funny, actually.
It is a beautiful dream, but I think she's just going to be pissy.
Yeah. It's also not as beautiful as him in that wetsuit. Just saying.
It's true. He closes the scene with one more wink, but if you're afraid, this is a serious rap on Todd. There is more of him, so yay.
Phew.
On to our B plot. Jen and CJ and Jack and David go deep on issues. We open here with Jen on the phone, sort of canceling a caller, but mostly confirming what they apparently think about the bleak futility of life in a mechanized society. Before too long, CJ stops her because this is only a practice call and he doesn't think the imaginary person wanted to talk to Kierkegaard. Jen snits that CJ said the imaginary caller was a philosophy major and then quits the stand, which, like, yes, you should have stayed pre-quit. It makes no sense. You would come back to this after the blow up over him and Audrey, but
yeah,
whatever. There has to be a reason for them to be around each other, I guess. And apparently this is it. Clip 12.
If the training consists of sitting here for a week and listening to you act superior to me?
I've been doing this for 2 years.
Great. Well, maybe your expertise will come in handy when we get to a hypothetical situation involving casual sex and a couple of blonde girls.
Maybe you're right about one thing. Let's call it a day. So, come back tomorrow or don't come back, but whatever you decide, you should make it about you, not me.
Don't come back.
Don't come back.
Don't ever go there again.
Don't
forget his name. The alphabet has 24 letters now. Just move on.
But even granting that for some reason Jen was moved to try peer counseling now after rejecting the offers for the entire other first half of the season.
Out of spite, I guess.
Regardless of the reason, CJ and his 2 years experience should have told her to get any other person to train her for exactly this reason.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Dumb. Mm-hmm. Over to a clinic where Jack is waiting nervously. Joining him, David also seems stressed, but he's just kidding about the magazine collection. Jack can't believe that David's not anxious about what they're doing, and I guess the WB censor didn't want them to say out loud that they're getting tested for STIs, but context clues make that pretty clear. David has done this a million times before, he says. He would not be a very good peer counselor if he didn't practice what he preached. The most embarrassing part is when they ask what kind of high-risk activity you've engaged in over the past 6 months, and all David can come up with is eating carbs after 9 p.m. and jaywalking, which is not a bad line.
Mm-hmm.
He promises that Jack will be fine moments before a staffer calls Jack's full government name. So much for privacy.
Yeah, really.
Then we return to the stand the next day. Jen seems like she's taking my advice and getting trained by David, but he is just playing a slutty straight guy for practice and not convincingly, according to Jen. Clip 13.
What? What? I have nailed many a hot girl in my day.
Hey, I believe you.
Thank you. I can't believe I volunteered to help you guys and get criticized for my acting abilities.
Oh, please, like you could ever be straight. Your heart is too big and so is your brain.
She's hostile.
Told you.
Could you please not talk about me like I'm not in the room? So I have some anger. Can you tell me that there's something wrong with expressing your emotions?
Well, this is not the context. No. It is not supposed to be about you, but it's not supposed to be about CJ either.
Yeah. Also, don't be a Kathy cartoon. Oh my God, end this fucking show, please.
Yes. This is when Jack arrives to collect David, who asks if CJ and Jen can get along without him the next day. Clip 14.
Whoa, wait a second. I mean, the only reason you're hanging around here afternoon instead of wasting time with me is because she can't manage to get along with him?
Shut the fuck up, first of all.
Shouldn't you know this? You're best friends and you live together, don't you?
They don't
you?
Live together anymore. Oh, she okay. lives with Grams. He lives with Paisley.
Oh, right. He lives with what's-its.
But he is apparently going to skate through the whole rest of the series, not being found out as a bad friend who kept crucial CJ intel from Jen. I'm still not over it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Jen is also booing. Clip 15.
Are you mad at me, too? You can't loan me your boyfriend for one measly hour. Is he your boyfriend? Have you guys kissed yet? Did I miss all of this over Christmas vacation?
Charming. Let's go.
Well, did she answer the question? We don't know that either.
Yeah.
Annoying.
Mm-hmm. Were you in the backseat of Pacey's car when it crashed into the Leary house? Like, what?
Well, Jack was in Europe with extremely off-screen Andy and extremely not dead in the world of the show, but dead in real life. They're
good dead. Old angry. We miss him.
As they leave, CJ gives Jen a long, withering look and then walks out, muttering hostile as he passes by. Man, fuck this guy. I was into
Seriously.
It and I'm not anymore.
Yeah, not at all.
After a truly pitiful Joey has slumped away from them at Hell's Kitchen, and we'll get to her soon, David comments to Jack that there's nothing sadder than watching someone wait for a phone call they're never going to get. Jack suggests that sick orphans are sadder than Joey, plus Eddie might still call her. Clip 16.
Oh, please. We're guys, aren't we? How many people have you ruthlessly hooked up with and never called?
You?
Okay, the first two times I listened to that, I thought that was, is there anyone who you've never called? You? But it's a few. It's just he's kind of mush-mouthed. They go on. Clip 17.
Look, I went out a lot this summer, right? And I didn't call a few of the guys back. Look, if a straight guy did, it would be rakishly charming. You know, look, you meet someone, okay, you think you're gonna like him.
And then after closer examination, you don't.
Yeah.
But only after the closer examination part.
Basically, you gonna give me some kind of lecture here or what?
Do you want one?
Not particularly.
Fine.
Fine.
Great. Thanks. Also, wasn't he with, what's his whole summer?
He was with him for some of the summer. And
oh,
then
okay.
He came out to his parents and took off, I guess. It's unclear.
I think Jack got dumped by email.
That's
I
right.
I forget the timeline.
Yes, yes. He was. But we saw in the premiere that he was also hooking up with a bunch of guys and then hustling them out of Graham's house.
Oh,
behind
yeah.
her back.
God, it seems like another life.
Doesn't it? Back to the stand, where Jen is intensely telling a caller that having a bad relationship with her father doesn't mean that a girl can't sustain a romantic relationship, then announces that her very first real, non-hypothetical caller hung up on her. Why did it have to be boy trouble? CJ, sitting across from Jen, says somebody probably just walked in and the caller didn't want to be overheard, but Jen is convinced that she fucked it. And when her phone rings again, CJ says it's probably the same girl and she'll want to resume talking to Jen. But Jen panics that she'll mess it up. So CJ picks up, and from his side of the conversation, we could tell everything he guessed about the caller was correct. He also tells the girl it's Jen's first day and she's a little high strung, which not necessary, and don't undermine your colleagues.
Yeah, doesn't help the caller either. That's really not cute.
CJ tells the caller to try again in 10 minutes when whoever's in the room with her has gone, and Jen gazes at him moonily, probably falling in love with him again like a real fucking idiot. And at the stand the next day, CJ reads while Jen complains that the phone's not ringing more. CJ says, it doesn't work like that. It takes a lot for stubborn people to figure out they need help or admit they were wrong. Jen is ramping up to something important when he looks over, sees it's 4 o'clock, and announces he's going for coffee. Jen panics that if he leaves her alone, the phones will start ringing for sure, and she won't know what to do. Clip 18.
You know what you're doing, and I don't, which is why you shouldn't go.
You know, a few days ago, you couldn't stand being in the same room with me, and now you don't want me to leave.
That was a week ago. Can a person change in a week?
I don't know. Can she?
Shut up! You're a jerk.
Yeah. You're a jerk, you're boring, and you make no sense.
Nope. When CJ leaves and Jen picks up the book he has left, she mutters that it's Kierkegaard. Sure enough, as soon as CJ has ordered his coffee outside, the phone rings. Jen can see him through the window waiting for his coffee, but she bravely picks up, and when CJ turns around, he sees her talking and he smiles. We cut back inside to see Jen admit she's not totally sure she can help the caller, but she wants to try. So I guess that's the win we were looking for here. But CJ still stinks, and all of this was not going the way it should have.
No. And like, it was also boring.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks. Great job.
At the clinic, Jack joins a waiting David carrying his test results. Nothing to tell. They go on. Clip 19.
You know, all that stuff that we talked about yesterday, did that fundamentally alter your opinion of me in any way?
Yeah, right. Like I couldn't tell from a mile away that you were going to end up being way sluttier than me.
What?
Well, come on, Jack, give me a little credit. I mean, look at you. You're ridiculously good looking. I mean, you know Vigo.
Yeah, okay, kinda... that's great. Let's go.
What, we're leaving?
Well, yeah. You don't honestly think I'm going to stand here and have this conversation with you?
I'm sorry, but I sort of think that I really
David.
Found... Yeah?
Shut up.
Yeah, I think I could do that.
Okay, they've kissed at least once. So, okay. Great.
I'm not sure I get the, like, sexual chemistry, but they are cute as, mm-hmm. like, friends.
Yes.
And they're both cute. So, mm-hmm. fine.
Finally, we have our A plot, desperately seeking Eddie. We open this storyline watching Joey leave Eddie a long message on the phone on Tuesday. She's trying to be breezy, but it's clear they have not talked since the holidays. When she hangs up, she hears a bratty voice telling a group of older guys at the pool table she's not 16, she's totally 18, and it's Harley. When Joey drags her away, Harley reveals that she's living with Hetson full-time now and asks where Eddie is, since he still owes her that root beer float. Joey does not bother hiding her smile at the cosmic justice that her tormentor Hetson is now stuck with a tormentor of his own because, as Harley goes on to whine, her mother's doing research in Bangladesh. Joey has to admit she doesn't know where Eddie is. Harley goes on at length about how great he is and how dumb Joey was to fuck it up with him. Joey will get Harley a root beer float if Harley promises to go back to school. And as discussed in one of our previous episodes, Joey is in Hetson's class either again or still, and somehow it's even worse. Clip 20.
Well then, since nobody seems up to the rhetorical challenge of convincing me that Norman Mailer was wrong when he dismissed all female writers as unreadable, that's it for Wednesday.
You don't have to engage in an argument that was made in bad faith. Sir.
Yeah. Also, we already hate you and find you superfluous. You did not have to drag Norman Mailer into it to make yourself even more loathsome.
No.
We were already there.
Yes.
Bye-bye.
After class, Joey forces herself to stop at his desk on her way out. Clip 21.
Oh, that can't be Joey Potter. Guess 1D isn't enough to get anyone thrown out of Worthington anymore.
Sweet. Really. Your overwhelming concern for my future, but that's actually not why I'm subjecting myself to your toxic personality.
Great. Then I'll skip ahead to the part where I inform you that no matter how many times you ask, it will never be possible for you to drop this course without forfeiting your credits from the first semester.
That doesn't make anything clearer.
No.
How this works.
Not an explanation. That's not how courses work. at the college level. Don't get it. I don't want to have to get it. No. I don't care.
No. Anyway, Joey tells Hetson that Harley might not be as safely ensconced in Milton Academy as he currently thinks she is. Even an English prof can't parse that, so Joey has to normally say that Harley ditched a field trip to come to Hell's Kitchen looking for Eddie. Hetson, who as we've previously seen is an indifferent father at best, improbably gets offended at what he thinks is Joey's judgment of his parenting, offering a new deal. She stays out of his life and he'll stay out of hers. Joey snits that this is about something more than his gigantic male ego and stomps out. When we return to Hell's Kitchen the next day, Joey's leaving another message for Eddie, this one a lot more manic, as she acknowledges that he's avoiding her but admits that she's scared something happened to him and she wouldn't know since she's not important to him, but he should please call her back anyway. She mopes into the dining room and plops down in a booth with Jack and David. They both assure her, not very convincingly, that Eddie's gonna call and there's probably a logical reason that he hasn't already. So Joey asks them to settle up so that she can leave. And then Joey and her dumb hat, which you can see in the visual aids, are on their way out when she sees Harley flirting at the pool table again. Joey barks at her to get her coat. They're leaving. Harley obviously knows Joey has no authority over her and says that her cutting class again is Joey's punishment for snitching on her to Hetson and getting her grounded. Joey's not leaving Harley alone with a possible date rapist, whom I guess Joey doesn't hope to get any tips from in the future. She picks Harley's coat up off the pool table and shuffles out, and I guess Harley really likes that coat because she goes with her. And we rejoin them on Eddie's block as Harley natters at Joey about bringing her to a bad neighborhood. Joey says that Harley's father's in class and Joey's sick of dealing with Harley, so they're doing this, buzzing Eddie's apartment and failing to notice the for rent sign right beside the door. As Joey mutters about losing track of a guy she thought was her boyfriend, Harley surmises that they slept together. Joey snits that she forgot what a woman of the world Harley is. She probably lost her virginity years ago to a trucker named Bubba, right?
Oh, he's back.
He's
back. Trucker named Bubba.
I'm so sick of this joke. It's not funny anytime.
Didn't miss him either.
That's when someone else comes out, and Joey hustles Harley in. And upstairs, she knocks on Eddie's door, which sort of pops out at her, not how doors work, so that they can both enter and see the place is empty. Harley doesn't get what the big deal is. Joey just went into the wrong apartment, right? But Joey can't answer because she's busy tearing up. And back in Hetson's class the next day, Joey endures a lecture about Donald. I thought it was Bartleby based on how he's pronouncing it, but it was the author Donald Bartleby, apparently.
Uh-huh.
He calls on her because she looks distracted and also because she is his designated victim and also because no one else is getting paid to talk in this episode, clip 22.
Okay, pick a story, any story. Wait, I'll pick one for you. The school, how about that? Ring any bells?
Yes.
What's it about?
It's about a teacher who's trying to explain something to his students.
What's he trying to explain?
Death and loss.
Why is he trying to explain it?
Because it keeps happening to them over and over again, like this endless cycle. I mean, first the orange trees, then the herb garden, then the tropical fish. You know, it's absurd, really, because one minute they're there, the next minute they're gone. And the thing that's true, the part of it that's true, the part of it that's real, is that no one ever does explain it to him because no one can.
That's great, Joey. Of course, you forgot all about the snakes and the puppies, but, oh, look, we're out of time for today.
Just fuck off. All of you in this entire section of the story, fuck off forever.
Yeah.
That's great, Joey. What? Okay.
Dear listener, if you would like to find out how close Joey's analysis is to anything cogent, you can actually read this story. It's at the New Yorker website. We linked it in the show notes. After class, Hetson stops Joey, thrusting a 50 at her. She freezes, and clip 23.
Okay, look, I know you're poor, but don't tell me you're so poor you've never seen 50 bucks before.
That made me laugh. It was just funny to think she didn't know what it literally looked like. Anyway, it's for looking after Harley yesterday. Hetson doesn't want to have to be nice to Joey for the rest of the semester because he owes her. But like Joey said the other day, this isn't about him. Harley's mother is gone, and her dad is a gigantic scuzz bucket? Joey asks to finish his thought. and Hudson doesn't disagree. Harley has no use for him most days, but she seems to like Joey. Clip 24.
Yeah, well, I'm very likable.
Wrong. Ask around.
Nope.
Not.
Yeah, you're just not.
Joey adds that she's likable but poor. Hudson offers her $50 to hang out with Harley 3 times a week. Joey counters at 65, and she'll even help Harley with her homework. Not that he would probably want her to offer her D student help. And then Joey shoves this 50 back at him. There's no charge for yesterday, and she can't say why. He wouldn't understand. And that's where we leave all these idiots for another week. Close it up by naming our MVP. Eddie left, did not come back.
Yeah, but if that had been a series wrap, I could have given it to him. But yeah, I got to go with David. You know, just mm-hmm. like is normal, has yeah. a reason to be there.
Mm-hmm. How about that? Least valuable player.
CJ, eat a dick, bro.
Yeah, good call. I was going to say Grinaldi, but CJ is actually worse than him in this episode, which is saying something and not something good.
No. Speaking of not something good, next time on Again With This, Harley gets Joey and Eddie to make up, Audrey's return to campus, and the band turns into a cock-up, and Rinaldi just might be setting Pacey up, Bren's derogatory. And speaking of derogatory, our visual aids. That's the key screenshots and GIFs for every episode of the Again With This podcast, regardless of show. You can find those along with the full archive of the episodes themselves on our website, againwiththispodcast.com. I'm side ponytail of debauchery, Sarah D. Bunting, and I'm on Blue Sky at Sarah D. Bunting. My co-host is future endeavor Tara Ariano, and she's on Blue Sky at Tara Ariano. And our producer, David T. Cole, is very likable. Talk to you next time.
Dawson, do better.